I think we're going to be covering a lot of those topics indeed tonight. Now, my guest has been researching flying saucers for over 48 years. He and others personally witnessed these craft while growing up along the southern New Mexico border. His discoveries led to much different answers than has been propagated by the government for over a half a century. My guest, William Line, was born in Big Spring, Texas, and he was raised in West Texas oil boom towns and ranching country. He had a top-secret clearance in Air Force intelligence. He earned a Bachelor of Science degree with a double major in art and industrial technology from Sam Houston State University in Huntsville, Texas, acquiring an MFA in studio arts from the University of Texas at Austin in 1969, and he has lived in New Mexico for over 28 years. Now, in 1975, he rejected a high-paying and prestigious executive CIA position offered by then-director George Bush because he believes the National Security Act of 1947 is an illegal betrayal of American sovereignty and liberty, and that the flying saucer, as he claims is man's greatest invention, should be enjoyed by all. He believes that the USA government should be prohibited from engaging in covert and illegal mind control of the American people because it fraudulently violates our Bill of Rights by circumventing our right to fully informed consent or refusal. Again, as I mentioned, he began researching flying saucers that led to his books. He's been doing it for over 48 years. And this is interesting, too. He recognized the Roswell incident as a bungled hoax when it was created in 1947 by military intelligence personnel at Holloman Air Force Base in Alamogordo and perpetrated in the vicinity of nearby Roswell. And without further ado, it's my pleasure to welcome to the program tonight Bill Line. Good evening, Bill.
Hello, Michael. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, and thank you for being on the program with us.
I'm glad to be here.
It seems like we've covered, the intro, we've covered a lot of different aspects of what we're going to be talking about tonight. Basically, kind of give me an idea, about what we're dealing with here.
Well, basically, what we're dealing with is at the very bottom line is we're dealing with a technology that is being concealed with all kinds of convoluted stories and hoaxes and shams and so forth.
Okay.
And this technology has the capacity to pretty much alter our economic and social life as we now know it.
All right.
Having suppressed this stuff for as long as they have, it's sort of like a dam. It's built up. And eventually this change will come, no matter what. The technology will come out, and when the change comes, it will, I believe, be a change for the better, because I think the technology basically takes power and over our lives away from the elite and empowers the individual as he's never been empowered before.
Okay. All right. Now, this all sounds really incredible. And I know we're going to be spending, a couple of hours going through 48 years of research that has led you to this conclusion. Let's start with Nikola Tesla.
All right. Now, Tesla, in the 1890s, well, let's go all the way back to his very beginning.
Okay.
When he was a young man and considering what he was going to do with his life, he had decided to pursue this one electric flying machine idea that he got in the as early as the 1870s.
Okay.
And I believe that it was probably stimulated by some writings of Michael Faraday and J.J. Thompson, William Thompson, and several of the other top physicists and geniuses in the world. And as it turned out, I believe he was kind of in a race with the top guns as to who arrived at the technology first. And by 1893, he had completely worked out something he called the dynamic theory of gravity, which he said explained the movement of all bodies in space and gravity and momentum and inertia and everything. And however, he had a technology that he was working on, and he couldn't publish that theory until he could protect his inventor's rights in that technology.
Right.
If he published the theory, then everybody and his uncle could have gone out and taken credit for his work by building the thing first, because in our invention system in America, the person who makes it first is the one who is deemed to be the inventor.
Right, right.
And the English may have, I'm not sure what the differences are in England, but I know that Thompson had tried to beat Tesla to the punch, but obviously was working partly off of Tesla's ideas. He came up with a formula for the amount of momentum that was stored in an electromagnetic field.
This was back in the late 1800s.
Yeah, that was about 1893, which was already a couple of years after Tesla had lectured in England on the subject.
Okay.
He was invited over there after he gave some lectures in Columbia College and a few other places that obviously attracted their attention.
Mm-hmm.
They got him over there. They picked his mind, and then he came back home. He took his apparatuses with him, his various generators and so forth. So he went into England and demonstrated this stuff right before their eyes with all the technology, things that they didn't even believe that were possible to achieve. They were just speculating on the possibilities, and he brought the equipment over there and did it. And as far as actually making something, propelling something through space, I don't know whether he did that or not in that demonstration.
Okay.
But by 1915, he'd already tested something he called his dirigible torpedo, which he said was capable of what this was a remotely powered and remotely controlled electropropulsive flying machine that, as he described, had no ailerons, fins, propellers, rockets, any outer appurtenances of any kind were not on it. The only thing it was, as best you can conceive of it, is some sort of a capsule and metallic, and it was, he could project it through space, drop it down in the ocean, bring it back up, hover it in midair, send it out to the target, or bring it back to the base.
Sounds a lot like the behavior characteristics of UFOs.
Yes. And he said it was capable of 300 miles per second, which is about 1.8 million miles per hour. And at that speed, it seems impossible in our atmosphere. But when I saw a flying saucer in 1953, I realized that the rules just don't apply.
Of course, they don't. They don't appear to.
It's a totally different school of physics there.
Uh-huh.
That's been concealed from us.
Now, Nikola Tesla was what? The inventor of AC current, wasn't he, or AC electricity?
Yeah, he was the first person to come up with alternating current because he knew that by stepping the voltage up very high and using alternating current, you could carry a tremendous amount of power over long distances without the great losses you had in DC current.
Right. He was also, I think, credited with assisting Marconi with the invention of the radio. Is that true?
Well, Marconi actually plagiarized Tesla's stuff. The first patent description that Marconi shone with is actually plagiarized from the wrong kind of antenna. It shows a radar antenna, more or less, a parabolic antenna, which wasn't any good for radio. And that's the reason he had to use so much power to get that message to go such a short distance, is he had the wrong kind of antenna.
Right.
And it was later ruled in 1943, after, unfortunately, Tesla's death, that he was the inventor of radio. And that is in some of his earliest patents, his high-frequency patents.
Now, for some of my listeners out there, I know that myself, years ago when I heard about Nikola Tesla, it seemed like I was always seeing his name associated with, you know, kooky kind of things. However, what you find when you do research is that Tesla was not a kook. He was a very intelligent man and someone who has contributed a great deal to our modern-day society.
Well, the thing that, unfortunately, which contributed to Tesla's reputation as a kook was his irrepressible sense of humor.
Uh-huh.
He was a big practical joker. And Mark Twain was one of his very good friends, and they liked to play practical jokes.
Okay.
And the kind of people they loved to play practical jokes on were the people who were always jabbering about paranormal stuff.
Oh, I see.
Spiritists.
Okay.
And Tesla would play all kinds of... He even played practical jokes, I'm convinced, on his biographer, John J. O'Neill.
Okay.
Because O'Neill was invited to a dinner, and he was you know, licking his chops ready for a sirloin steak or something like that. And Tesla was actually entertaining two Serbo-Croatian boxers who'd come to New York to fight in a fight. And they all had scrambled eggs, which was a big disappointment for O'Neill.
Yeah.
And this was at the Waldorf Astoria, by the way. And claimed that he felt some stickly, you know, feeling in his back and heat and so forth, which he thought was an exhibition of a paranormal presence because he was in Tesla's presence.
But in fact, it was...
Yeah, apparently Tesla had something
going
in the room that was putting out microwaves or something of that nature and was heating up O'Neill's back, making him think he was having a paranormal experience. It was just a joke because O'Neill continually wanted to give a paranormal tinge to Tesla. And at one point, the Ford Foundation, a couple of people came into Tesla's office to try to talk him into doing some paranormal research with the Ford Foundation. He said he never got closer to firing two men out of his office in his life.
Wow.
He was so infuriated that they would, and insulted that they would think he would participate in psychic research.
Right.
This was back, you know, before the war. This was back in the 30s.
In the 30s. My guest is Bill Lyon. We're talking about his research over 48 years that has led him to the conclusion that flying saucers aren't the product of alien technology. And we're finding out why he has drawn that conclusion. Welcome back to the program, Bill.
Hello. Yeah, I was enjoying your music there for a minute.
Oh, well, thank you. We like our music, too. We really like it.
There's a synthesized version of that, The Planets.
Is there?
Yes, by a Japanese composer named, or musician named Tomita. It's very nice.
Yeah. Well, I'll have to check that out. We get a lot of people calling us about our music. They really like it. Now, before we go any further into the Tesla stuff, let's talk about your research and how you got introduced to all of this.
Well, I was intrigued by airplanes from the time I was maybe 3 or 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
During the very early days of the beginnings of World War II, some of my neighbors were flyers, and my uncle was a flyer. And so I was kind of around that. That's what you grow up in, around in West Texas a lot. You did.
Uh-huh.
So many people were flyers, I guess because of the wide open spaces, it was a good way to get around. And many ranchers were flyers, so there was a large number of flyers in the area. And so I was a Navy brat during World War II. I was really interested in airplanes more than ships, and had, you know, had studied airplanes. I really devoured every book I could get on airplanes of any kind. And so 1946 or 1945, I guess it was 1946, we returned to West Texas at the end of the war. And shortly after we returned, well, some of my neighbors and others in the surrounding area in the little oil town had reported seeing these, what they called flying discs, in the area of southern New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And these were pumpers that would, at that time, the population of southern New Mexico was very sparse in 1946. It was just a few people there. It was
just a lot of desert.
Yes. And these guys would live in West Texas, and they would go up there. The oil companies would send them up there to check their pumps out and keep them running on a periodic basis. So they would make periodic trips up into southern New Mexico. They would go all the way up to the Roswell area or so, and checking these pumps, and they would see these flying discs in the area. They, of course, the areas they were going to were surrounding the Alamogordo area and the White Sands area.
All the top secret military sites.
Yes. And the moment I heard about those flying discs, I became really intrigued because everyone in that area knew that southern New Mexico was largely inundated after the war by a lot of the German scientists, rocket people, and so forth.
Right.
And everyone knew about it because these people, they couldn't keep them cooped up. They would make weekend trips about the area, and so people got to know some of them. And my father had bought an old POW camp out of Roswell, which was used to house a lot of these prisoners. The ones from Rommel's Afrika Corps were taken to that camp. And so after the war, you couldn't get any building materials and so forth. And so my dad had bought this whole base and brought it down to our little town of Kermit and built the first motel that was there.
Kermit, Texas.
Yes.
Yeah.
And but in the process, we had several friends out of Roswell and Alamogordo and so forth, and we would pick up a lot of information. It was like here I was, a little 7, 8, 9-year-old kid, just like a little spy, just picking up everything he could pick up about these things.
Yeah.
And I never for a moment ever thought they were extraterrestrial. And, of course, in 1947, I was in Roswell a couple of times because my father played in golf tournaments up there. And I think I saw one of those discs at a distance glinting in the sun, but I couldn't be sure it wasn't just an airplane. And when the Roswell event occurred later, we heard some pretty solid rumors that they were basically the things that were being seen were some sort of secret German aircraft that we'd gotten at the end of the war. And we heard stories like the reason we wondered why the AEC seemed to have jurisdiction every time anyone got close to one of these things or mentioned them. Well, the AEC seemed to be involved, and so that's the old Department of Defense or Department of Energy, DOE, and was the DOE was called Atomic Energy Commission at the time. And,
right.
And so my mother had heard that the reason that they had jurisdiction was because these things used a nuclear reactor that used helium.
Really?
So that kind of confused me a little bit because helium didn't seem to be the kind of thing you'd use in a nuclear reactor. Now I know better. I understand what was going on is the helium was used to produce the electrical power. And you can produce tremendous electrical power with helium. And it's basically a type of free energy in the sense that it captures energy from space.
Now, you maintain that the Roswell event was a elaborate hoax.
Yes.
Why? In other words, what was the basis of that? You heard
one,
the rumors.
A number of things. First of all, I just figured, well, this is just a fancy way to cover this up. I was a pretty sharp little kid. I'm not a suspicious person by nature.
Right.
I'm not paranoid or anything like that. I mean, I know some people who are really paranoid, but I'm not. I'm the kind of person that will try to fight off anything that seems unwarranted until I have something solid. And I had no reason to believe that couldn't be a type of aircraft.
Did something actually crash out there? Was one of these test aircraft?
No. Later on, I verified this several years later. I got verification on it. But in about 1959, my brother-in-law's mother told me that her sister had told her they were rhesus monkeys. The so-called aliens were rhesus monkeys.
Uh-huh.
And turns out that my brother-in-law's family were from Blazer's Mill in Mescalero, New Mexico, which is where Robert Goddard had his rocket research.
Mm-hmm.
Operation. It was in Mescalero, and he tested them in Eden Valley. Anyway, his family, my brother-in-law's family, was from that area, and his aunt was the Army nurse that later became a nun, the one who was present during the so-called autopsy. Actually, it was a dissection of a rhesus monkey.
Okay, talking with Bill Lyne tonight. He spent 48 years researching UFOs and has come to the conclusion that they're advanced technology that is promulgated from Nikola Tesla's research, as well as some of the stuff the Nazis were working on in advanced airframe, if you will. Bill, going back to the Roswell incident, now, I'm under the impression, at least I'm reasonably sure, that something crashed out there, but I'm not necessarily sure that was an alien spacecraft. Are you saying that nothing crashed out there, but they staged this whole thing as an elaborate hoax?
What they did was they set up they took a mock-up of a flying saucer, which was atomic in its appearance, and they took it out there. They took a a bulldozer and cut a gash in the ground, and he stuck this little aluminum fake flying saucer in there with rhesus monkeys dressed in G-suits. And the whole thing was, I had heard, like I say, in 1958, I'd heard about the rhesus monkeys.
Right.
And I'd gotten information from other people over the years. In 1960, I worked for 2 weeks closely with Jesse Marcel, who was working for a paint company out of Florida. And I was a store manager for a Mary Carter paint company in Midland, Texas at the time. And he was sent in there to do some, you know, some orders from the headquarters type of work. And so I worked with him a couple of weeks, and I asked him about that, and he didn't say anything about any alien ideas or any of that sort of stuff. He was pretty practical about it, but a little closed mouth about it. But he had trained in Midland to drop the atom bomb, and at the Midland Air Park is where they perfected the technique. And he was a pilot who had been trained in that technology.
Of course, now Jesse Marcel said on camera that whatever it was that crashed out there wasn't from what he thought wasn't from this earth.
Are you talking about the father or the son?
I'm talking about the father.
Well, the father was under security clearance. He was, you know, the CIA had come into existence.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. You were talking with Jesse Marcel Jr.
No, I was talking with Senior.
Okay, all right. But he told you there was nothing to it.
Yeah, you know, what he would share with me would be different than what he would say on the camera because he was being forced to say something.
As far as I know, an alien spacecraft did not crash in Roswell, New Mexico in 1947.
He's going to be impeached.
That was
our fearless leader.
Yeah. Well, that's absolutely true. Yeah. You know, now what I saw, now, let me tell you, around 1970 or 71, I think it was 71, I had a girlfriend who worked at a newspaper, and she had told him that I was interested in flying saucers and so forth. And mm-hmm. So he invited me down. He said he had something he wanted to show me. And he was very hush-hush and about the whole thing. And so he had these two photographs, which he gave me, which he said he'd found at an old newspaper office down in, I believe it was Lovington. Dusty old room in the back, had an old desk, and these photos were in the bottom of the desk. And they were stamped on the back, U.S. Army. They were 8.5 or 8x10 glossies, and they were stamped on the back, you know, U.S. Army Airfield Roswell or something of that nature. And so he gave me these two photographs and said, be real careful with them. Don't let the wrong people find out you have them. And the two photographs, one of the photographs was of the little corny little flying saucer they constructed.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was of the rhesus monkeys in G-suits. And it was a ghastly picture. It was absolutely one of the most ghastly pictures I've ever seen because the rhesus monkeys had been shaved, put into these G-suits, and they were still in these G-suits when the photographs were made, and it appeared to me that the photograph was made before the hoax was perpetrated.
Why would the government do that, though? Why would they perpetrate a hoax like that? I mean,
very simple. Flying saucers were being seen all over the place by everybody.
So they wanted people to think they were alien spacecraft?
Yeah, and they wanted the local people to think they were coming from outer space because everyone was seeing them. They were all over the place.
Did they anticipate the national coverage or actually the international coverage they got?
I don't think so, because these photographs were sent out with the news release just in the local areas. They weren't mailed all over the country. I'm convinced that the hoax was cooked up
just for the locals.
Yeah, by ex-Nazi military personnel, military intelligence personnel at Alamogordo, perpetrated over in Roswell. And the purpose of it was to convince everybody these things were coming from outer space.
Right.
Because they were testing them. See, if you look at the mission of these different bases, well, Holloman, that's a fighter interceptor base, among other things, and they did a lot of testing there. They did a lot of testing on acceleration, and they had a rocket sled there. And sometime around 1946 or so, maybe 47 even, I remembered seeing a newsreel where they showed rhesus monkeys being used in acceleration tests in G-suits and on the rocket sled. And they used rhesus monkeys until maybe 1950. Then they started using chimpanzees because rhesus monkeys were harder to control. But rhesus monkeys, these are kind of like a tailless East Indian type of monkey. And the reason my uncle, my brother-in-law's aunt knew about them is she was in the Bataan Death March. She was a survivor of the Bataan Death March. And in the Bataan Peninsula, they ate rhesus monkeys and pepper. That was their main diet there. So she had been treated to that delicacy when she was a prisoner of the Japanese during the war. And when they took these rhesus monkeys from the Hoke site, brought them into Roswell and started cutting them up like they were some kind of aliens, they were going through all this stuff like you'd go through a silly play, you know, where you would take maybe an apple and pretend it was a heart or something. And she was laughing behind their backs because she knew they were rhesus monkeys. She'd eaten them before. She knew what they looked like cut up.
Now, what you're maintaining here in your thesis is that essentially the science that Nikola Tesla has discovered and worked on has been co-opted, if you will, by the U.S. government, and that there's a, I guess you could say, for lack of a better word, a cabal that's controlling it.
Yeah. And I think, see, I think the way the Nazis, one of the intriguing things is how the Nazis got hold of the technology and started to develop it before the U.S. government did. And part of that is in the fact that Tesla was ignored and treated like he was nuts. He would go to the government and try to get them to back something, and they would treat him like some old crazy. And he was old. His invention hadn't been developed. J.P. Morgan and other huge interests had seen to it that Tesla couldn't get any money, couldn't get any backing for anything, because his ideas would put him out of business. So they just made it so that no bank would touch him, nobody would loan him any money. So along come the sly Nazi agents and sidle up to Tesla. They knew what his favorite pastime was. They had a guy who was highly cultured and highly intelligent sidle up to Tesla and probably made him, and this is the first time this has been published by anybody right now, they duped him and got him to cooperate, probably telling him that the laboratory was purely scientific in its nature.
Okay, let's take a break right here, okay? Coming back, Bill Lyon to the program, talking about his research. And, I want to say that I'm not convinced completely by what Bill has interpreted his data. However, I think his viewpoint does deserve serious consideration, because he's been talking about some things that over the years that I've been researching this topic, I've discovered that, some of the stuff is ringing very true, like the involvement of the Atomic Energy Commission. And, of course, as my audience knows, I'm not convinced that aliens are involved in saucers, and we've talked about the Nazi research angle before. Bill, thanks for being on the program. And tell me, real quick, kind of wrap up for us for this hour, the bottom line here. These people are controlling this technology. Where are they going to take it?
Generally, the people that are really controlling this technology are the mega corporations, the bankers and so forth. They're the ones that have the most to lose. They dribble this technology out to our government only for one reason, and it's a very limited use by the government. They dribble it out to the government so they can stamp it national security secret, and that way they can use the government to conceal it.
And they can continue making...
They want to conceal it for the next 100 years, if possible.
Okay, we've got about 30 seconds. Give out information as to how folks can contact you or get a hold of your books.
I have a website called Pentagon Space Aliens. You can do a search on that, or http://... members.tripod.com/tilde4lyne.
Okay. Let's kind of take and start there. What is the connection between mind control technology, UFOs, and this whole ball of wax?
Well, a couple of friends of mine disagree about the idea of exactly what mind control is. They claim that, real mind control is where you're just a zombie, you're turned. But I believe that if they, it's sort of like propaganda, if they can bring about a thought process in your mind and control that, that's mind control, in my opinion.
Right.
Without subjecting you to a total immersion in some sort of you know, total overhaul of your personality or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
If they can convince you through constant propaganda, if they can mesmerize you in such a way that your opinion automatically jumps to the wrong conclusion, people automatically think of aliens when they hear of or even see a flying saucer.
Yeah, people are very adamant about that.
Their heart jumps up in their throat, you know, and they lose total control and perspective. They usually can't even describe what they saw.
Right.
Because they're imagining this little green alien guy with almond-shaped eyes, you know, flying this thing.
Uh-huh.
And if they just, you know, open their eyes and look coolly at it, they could see it's just a damn machine.
Mm-hmm.
And there's electrical corona usually coming off the surface, which means that it's, it uses some form of high-voltage electrical power.
Right.
And that when it moves, it does 90-degree turns, so therefore it has to control momentum and inertia in some way. So
mm-hmm.
that tells us that there's some underlying physical principle involved that that controls the way bodies experience forces in space. And the only way that could be brought about is by controlling the actual processes that are occurring inside the body itself.
Mm-hmm.
Because, this couldn't just be something that exists out there in empty space, that this thing that causes the body to, you know, experience all these forces. And somehow, the books are just silent on what this force is. You know, why a body moving in one direction continues to move in that direction until it's acted upon by a stronger force and so forth and so on. You know, that just, they don't make any attempt to explain this. And here it is, you know, the very end of the 20th century, and with all this technology, they haven't told us a damn thing about what's going on inside the atoms and molecules when a body moves through space.
Now, let me ask you this, and we're assuming that that all of this stuff is correct. When the scientific, why has the scientific community failed to basically bring this kind of stuff to the public's awareness?
They're controlled by the National Security Act. You just wouldn't believe what they're capable or what they're empowered to do.
Well, actually, I probably would believe it, because
they can get any professor fired. They can set you up and throw you in jail. There's any number of things they can do legally under this act.
And they've actually gotten full control over all scientific discovery.
Definitely.
You know, this is very interesting, because a couple of weeks ago, I don't remember what guest I had, but I did something with the Eisenhower departure speech, when his farewell speech in 1960, when he was leaving. He was talking about the military-industrial complex. And one of the things that he said in that speech, and I wish I had it here in front of me, but I'm going to paraphrase a little bit, but he basically was talking about how science and technology is developed. It's completely different from the way people actually think it's done. That, you know, a lot of this money, that government money, does go to fund university research, and basically the way that they've got it structured, they do control the flow of any data coming out.
Yes.
Now, let's take a look at this. What is the, you know...
What I think Eisenhower did is, I think he salvaged anything that he did wrong when he made that speech.
Mm-hmm.
I think that absolves him. You know,
I think he was very concerned about it, too.
And because he could see the same military-industrial complex arising here that he'd fought in Europe to stop in the Nazi war machine.
Sure. And the one thing that I am very impressed with the fact is that Eisenhower himself was instrumental in some fashion for helping to bring a lot of those guys over here from Germany.
Yeah.
And he helped set up this whole entire scenario. And I think, like you said, by him mentioning that in his way out, he absolved himself of what he knew to be a reality that was raising its ugly head and taking control of this country.
Yeah. Most of this stuff occurred under Truman, you know, and it was already set up, you know, before the war was over.
Right.
You know, they already had this
in place.
Mechanisms in place. You know, they were doing behind the scenes manipulations before, during, and after the war. And you know, these people, you know, when Patton went to Peenemünde, which is something, and this is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
As the Allies moved into the area of Berlin, the Patton's tank corps did a special run all the way around Berlin and went to Peenemünde in the Baltic. and that has been obliterated from all of the war histories. I read that in 1957. And discussed it with the guys that I worked with in Air Force Intelligence, because many of them were involved in that. They were involved in Operation Paperclip. My supervisor was involved in Operation Paperclip.
Yeah.
He was the guy that rounded up the last holdouts of the SS. They called them the Wolfpack. So, you know, they recruited these guys. And, however, Patton made this run into Peenemünde, and he had intelligence officers disguised as tank commanders who were looking for flying saucers. That's what they were with his group for.
Right.
And they went to Peenemünde to get flying saucer material, as well as any rocket material that might be of strategic importance, and destroy it or get rid of it or take it back.
Right.
And when they went in there, Patton's men discovered 200 celestial guidance systems and a salt cave at Peenemünde.
What kind of guidance systems?
They were celestial guidance systems, like the one I show in my book, which is specifically made for flying saucers.
I see.
And I believe that this invention was actually one of Nikola Tesla's that he worked out with the Sperry Company back in 1917. He flew a plane, remotely controlled plane, with this system 100 miles or so and back or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe he developed that, but it wasn't. It's not shown in under any patent, you see, because apparently something's been played around with, removed from the books or whatever. But I believe it was specifically developed for the flying saucer.
Mm-hmm.
And the version I show, which I got from Sandia Base, it came from a salvage dealer in Albuquerque, but it was classified salvage, which was stolen by a Sandia Base employee who worked there and took salvage out of the base as his job, but he was apparently stealing classified salvage. He was just stealing salvage. He didn't realize he was classified salvage, selling it on his own and, you know, making receipts and so forth and so on, fabricating all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he sold it to the salvage dealer, and I bought it. I knew what it was the minute I saw it. I bought it, and when the government found out I had it, they went to the salvage dealer, and the salvage dealer referred him to the guy that sold it to him. They put him under surveillance, caught him doing it again, and threw him in jail.
Wow.
So that word got back to me, and I knew that this was a classified salvage, and that somebody had gone to jail over it.
Did they approach you?
They couldn't. Under the national security, under the rules, if they came and asked for that, they would be confirming that it is what I say it is.
I see.
And
I don't want to run the risk of doing that.
Right. They can't do that. They could have possibly steal it and throw it away or something.
That would open Pandora's box.
Open Pandora's boxes.
Yeah.
And so basically, and I did research on this on all kinds of devices, and this isn't shown anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
There's no record of this device in a German device book, and it's in Albuquerque in one of the libraries there. It's not shown in there at all. And it has a 360-degree turning situation. How many airplanes or whatever's turned that way? It has the 12 increments on it of 30 degrees each. And that's the reason I could recognize this for what it was. When I was about 8 or 9 years old, when people reported these flying saucers, I began to sleep in the backyard. I would sleep in the backyard around 9 months of the year. Most of the winter.
To keep an eye on things?
Yeah, to watch the skies. Plus, it was good for my sinusitis to sleep outdoors. It seemed to help it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would see these squadrons, whole squadrons of these ships in the dark. I would see whole squadrons of them flying in from New Mexico and maneuvering in increments of 30 degrees. They would come and they would turn 30, 60, 90, 180 degrees.
Is that what people are seeing in there out at Area 51 now?
Yeah, well, you can see them almost everywhere. However, where I live, they began to be very scarce recently because of my book and the research and so forth, and I pointed that out. So they've just kind of tried to find take most of their stuff to another area because people got aware of it and started watching the skies around here and seeing this stuff that's been hanging out over them forever. They just hadn't noticed it. You know, that's what I mean by mind control. People are conditioned not to look above the horizon. They just don't notice these things. I've seen these things outrageously right in front of people, and you don't notice them. And I can't figure out what is wrong with people where they can't see this. Don't they know that that's not a star and it's not an airplane?
Well, we could go into that and take hours to talk about it, but
yeah.
Basically I think they're asleep.
Yeah, it is amazing. I was in January of 96, I was in a hot tub at a Japanese bathhouse in Hyde Park above Santa Fe, and it was about 7 or so in the evening, just after dark, and I looked up above the mountains, and there were a couple of things going along, flashing, and I'm quite familiar with these. I watched them for years and years and years, and I said, there goes the flying saucer, and this guy across the tub says, ah, it's an airplane, and I said, there's another one, and I said, if it's an airplane, why did it just park?
In mid-air.
Yeah, and it was about 10,000 feet away from me at an angle, and it just they just both stopped in place there. And I said, when that the flashes keep you from seeing an underlying faint glow. And if they fly faster, the glow gets brighter. And that's the reason they're flying slowly, because when they fly fast, they light up brighter.
Mm-hmm.
The thing right on cue, it lit up. And it was huge compared to the flashing. Looked like a small plane. And this thing at arm's length, which is, say, 2 feet, it was 3/4 to an inch long. And maybe 3/4 of an inch wide. So at that distance, I estimate it to be approximately 250 feet wide by 400 feet long, shaped oval-shaped like a football field with a track around it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a dark green glowing color. It was shaped like a big lozenge, rounded. It had to be about 50 feet high, 250 feet wide, and 450 feet long, so that was big enough for, you know, that's a five-story building inside.
That's a big thing.
And it did a circle. It flew in a circle, and I estimated that to be 2,000 miles an hour based on approximately 10 seconds it took to make this circle,
mm-hmm.
and which encompassed a 30-degree angle. So at that distance, that would be about 2,000 miles per hour. It accelerated instantly. It did the big circle, came back, stopped right on a dime, right where it was before it took off in that circle. And as it flew, it had a purple Tesla corona, which was erupting in a space around the saucer, not directly from the surface, but you could see the corona developing outside the a dark area around the saucer. It was a kind of a blank space, and then the corona, the Tesla corona, went out like fingers and spider webs out in advance coming out from the surface. And is just like a Tesla discharge, that purple high-voltage electricity.
Again, this is another characteristic that we've heard many times described by witnesses.
Yeah. Now, when I first saw it, I realized that it was stealthized. It wasn't supposed to be visible.
Mm-hmm.
The dark green color was created somehow by some sort of surface coating to try to make it invisible at night and fade into the dark night sky. But because of the lighting conditions where the moon was and so forth, it was visible.
Mm-hmm.
And once I got fixed on it, everyone in the tub saw it. And I said, does everybody see that? As I followed it with my hand and as it flew around, and they were just aghast, of course. I mean, it was an electrifying experience to see one of those.
Right.
But I'd never seen one that big, and I frankly didn't think they were that big. That was the first time I'd seen a large ship. And however, I don't believe this crap about them being miles long. I know how they do that. That's a trick. But they use computers and a laser navigational interlock to control a whole squadron of these things, just like it was one craft, and they make this thing look like a tub, you know, that it's lights on a surface or something. They create an optical illusion.
And my guest is Bill Lyon. We're talking with him tonight on his research. He's done 48 years worth of research, actually, and he's amassed a considerable amount of data, which has culminated in a book. Actually, two books, Space Aliens from the Pentagon and Occult Ether Physics, Tesla's Hidden Space Propulsion System, and the Conspiracy to Conceal It. And Bill, what I'd like to do is pick up where we left off before we went to break. And let's talk about, again, going back to Tesla, let's talk about the man and his research, which I understand that when he died or shortly before he died, the government confiscated a considerable amount of scientific notes, data, that kind of stuff that he had, and that this stuff is still to this day classified.
Yes. When Tesla died, there's a lot of confusion, of course, naturally, because they helped to create plenty of confusion about it.
Mm-hmm.
They confiscated 80 large storage trunks full of papers.
Right.
And a few apparatus. And they released about 172 pounds to his relatives in Yugoslavia, which is the gist of the Nikola Tesla Museum. It was mostly historical papers that dated before, you know, 1910 or something, you know.
Right.
So they had, you know, literally that wouldn't be more than a trunk. So there's like 79 trunks left. And in 1979, I went to the, so soon after they opened the, what they called at the time, the National Security Research Center, which has later been renamed the J. Robert Oppenheimer Research Center.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of declassified material in there. That was during the Carter administration, and they declassified a lot of stuff. And I went up there and tried to get, I was doing research on Tesla. I had a bibliography, and I was running through their books and seeing what I could find. And everything in the bibliography, except a couple of or three articles, had been removed from the volumes. And in some cases, the whole volume was missing.
Jeez.
And some of these things are not, you know, are available that I was looking up. But as far as the rest of the material, I asked the librarian, you know, if I could have an index of material that was available on Nikola Tesla, and she said, "Do you have a badge?" And I said, "No." She says, "That material is all classified."
Okay.
And so I got a confirmation not only that they had it, but that it was classified there. And I imagine that they have either the original or duplicates, but I was amazed at the books they had there. They had original copies of the old English books that were published in London by the the Philosophical Society,
mm-hmm.
where most of these experimental philosophy papers were published by people like Faraday and the Thompsons and so forth and so on.
Right.
And they had the original volumes of these things. And however, the material on Tesla was all classified, except for the stuff that you can get from the Tesla Museum, which is what we have available. And so, you know, what could possibly have been? I found the hydrogen bomb plans available on the shelf.
But Tesla stuff, no way.
Yeah, and what could be more, you know, secret than hydrogen bomb plans that Tesla had?
Because sometimes you just never can figure out the mind of the government, right?
Yeah, and I went to a coffee place in Santa Fe and talked about this. I was infuriated. I was also trying to find material on hydrogen. That's how I found the hydrogen bomb plans. There was data I couldn't find on hydrogen. I found the hydrogen bomb plans, but I couldn't get Tesla stuff. So I was infuriated, and this guy who was sitting next to me, he was a Harvard graduate student. He went up there, he left immediately, went up there, got copies of, and made a copy of the hydrogen bomb plans, went back to Harvard where he was a student and created a sensation about it.
Jeez.
And then they subsequently withdrew the hydrogen bomb plans from the open shelf, you know, for the public.
No, it's too late after that point.
Yeah.
God. I mean, jeez. Now, what's happened to you? I mean, I understand that the research that you've done and your background and all of that, some weird things have happened to you.
Oh, to say the least.
Let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, when they made the offer to me, at the time, I was on a trip to Europe. And they created a situation at my home in New Mexico to get me back in the country so they could make the offer.
Now, when you say the offer, you talking about this George Bush offer?
Yeah, and it was made through a girlfriend, the lady I'd gone out with for 2 years. She turns out to be a CIA agent.
Oh, my goodness.
Who also owned an oil company.
Ooh.
And I didn't know either one of those things. And it was totally astounding. And then when I found out the first two things, she owned an oil company and she was a CIA agent, you could already knock me over with a feather. And then she makes this offer for George, on behalf of the CIA and George Bush, to give me this job. And it was an assistant directorship of the ninth. It was a director's. I was offered the job of director of the ninth region, provided I went back to my first wife. And that part was really crazy until I figured out all these people knew each other, that George Bush and my first father-in-law were butt-bumping buddies back in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And, You know, I mean, it was just cushy as hell, you know.
Of course, you all came from the same part of the world or the country.
Well, Bush is from Maine, but I didn't realize he was there in the 50s. And then I found out, oh, that's the Barbara and George that they kept talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
And, of course, he was the owner of Zapata Oil Company.
Yeah, well, so. I knew all those people, you know, that worked there. I knew a lot of those people at Zapata. I had a friend who was a co-owner of one of those companies.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in Midland, and when George Bush came into Midland, nobody liked him. They didn't trust him because his father had been a founder of the United Nations. They didn't trust him because he was like a counterfeit Texan. You know, he came in and started imitating a Texas accent and so forth. And later on, my first cousin was his private secretary in his Tidewater Oil Company in Houston, and that's where I met him. You know, I didn't care for the man when I met him, and I guess he just, I was always speculating why he had lit on my family, and the only thing I can come up with is we have some mineral rights his company was after or something. That's about the most I can think of, but the whole thing is so suspicious because the CIA lady was related to my first wife's family by marriage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just gets stickier in hell.
It's a nasty business.
Yeah. And, you know, they've got whole families in this. They get their kids in it. You know, it's you know, they start turning them into little spies when they're young.
Mm-hmm.
And that way nobody ever suspects that a kid's a CIA agent, but they actually use kids in this stuff.
I wouldn't be surprised.
I know they do.
Some of the stuff that we've heard, yes, I wouldn't be surprised. Your book, the I guess this is the first book you published, and then the Occult Ether Physics followed. Space Aliens from the Pentagon, if you don't mind me asking, this has got a very interesting cover. Can you explain to me what the significance of the Pentagon, of course, so you can see the Pentagon shape, and you've got the pyramid with the eye in the center and what appears to be a pentagram, and then embedded in the outer part of it is a swastika.
Well, there's a number of reasons I did it. Like, I show it as a maze.
Right.
And part of the maze is you have to go through the swastika to get to the swastika, rather,
uh-huh.
to get to the center where the pentagram is.
Right.
And the pentagram, of course, is you know, it's just my way of saying I think these people are into witchcraft or something, maybe.
Uh-huh.
That's just kind of a joke, but there's something to that. And the all-seeing eye of Bel or Horus or Ra or Ray.
Or the dollar bill, the back of the dollar bill.
Yeah. The Illuminati, basically.
Uh-huh.
And it's funny, here's a pentagon with a pentagram in the middle, a perfect, you know,
yeah.
Obvious thing. And, you know, so that was the idea, is to kind of create the feeling that I feel from the whole picture of the Pentagon and the secrecy and the Third Reich, because I think that the whole National Security Agency is basically just a transliteration of the organization that was responsible for concealing flying saucer technology in Nazi Germany.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there, because I think the
Reichssicherheitshauptamt basically means National Security Agency.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, again, going back to Eisenhower, I mean, what do people need? What more do people need than the highest official in the land to go on national television and say what he said about the military-industrial complex? I think for a long time the handwriting's been on the wall.
Yeah. Well, you know,
the big question I have, Bill, and you know, this probably sounds like conspiracy theory stuff, but the big question I have is, if they possess this technology, that makes me extremely uncomfortable. Why? Because the balance of power is obviously in their court. Why haven't they been a little bit more forthcoming in divulging this, i.e., you know, maybe some kind of a staged invasion or that type of thing? But or what is the bigger question is, what do they intend to do with this?
Well, you know, the size of that saucer that I saw at Hyde Park, it was big enough to put a whole battalion in.
Mm-hmm.
And I know from what I know about the technology, you know, the electromagnetic interaction is 10 to the 40th power times stronger than the gravitational interaction.
Mm-hmm.
That means it's thousands of millions of zillions of times stronger than the gravitational interaction. That means they can pick up anything with it with a small amount of electrical power. That's what makes it a – and this is science. This isn't somebody's
theory.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The force is there. This comes from reputable, acceptable sources, these differences in forces and so forth. And basically you take a strong force and replace a weak force with it, and you can control it with a small amount of energy, because a force exerted over a period of time will do, a stronger force will do more work for the same period of time than a weaker force will during the same time.
Okay.
So, you know, you can take a strong force and do a tremendous amount of work. Just, you can take a weak power source, convert it into a strong force, like electromagnetic force versus, you know, the ordinary gravitational force, running a motor, pick something up or something, and
right.
you can do an incredible amount of work with it.
What kind of characteristics would these devices have? I mean, are they capable of interstellar flight? Is that possible?
Yeah, I think so. It all depends on whether the ether, you see, that's the way they work. They pump the ether through the body.
Now, what is the ether?
The ether is a hyperfine material, sort of like neutrinos. I think they may even be, the neutrino might be the ether. Only there's different forms of the ether, the way it behaves at certain times. Now, you get one argument. Heinrich Hertz claimed that the ether was a solid, harder and tougher than any steel. But it's so hyperfine that we don't touch it. We can feel its effect when we move, but we go through it. Our atoms are much further apart and much, much thinner.
This fills all the empty space.
Yeah. And if we're moving through space and the ether's stationary, then we're moving over 70,000 miles an hour through this ether.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just permeating us all the time. And I think the gravity is a result of that, because of the electric field of the Earth. It polarizes the displacement
mm-hmm.
in the mass of our body down towards the Earth because of the negative pole of the Earth. The Earth is negative and the ionosphere is positive. And so that's what pulls us down, is that constant electric field that's working on that ether that we're moving through. And the ether can be pumped through the body, right through the atoms. And according to Faraday and all of these other guys, you have something called tubes of force that are developed in a body. These are electromagnetic force that are in little tubes that form around the ether when the body moves through the ether.
Mm-hmm.
So that these little tubes rotate, the magnetic field is known to cause that rotation of the electric charge. And it is my theory that these little rotating tubes have a screw effect, so that's what creates momentum, that it takes energy to change the pitch of those screws. And they're hollow screws. They're tubular cubes. They're hollow cubes that rotate around. And they will pull you through space once you start to move and create a certain pitch. And in order to change that, all you have to do is electromagnetically polarize those on another axis and
now,
you can turn on a dime.
This is all scientific theory, right?
Yeah.
We've never been able to see any of these things. We know that there might be something smaller than, what did you say, neutrinos?
Yeah. Well, neutrinos, to me, kind of match up to the ether. And the recent tests done by the Japanese, which incidentally come after my occult ether physics book,
mm-hmm.
They have purportedly measured the mass of the neutrino, and which they were arguing for years over whether they had mass,
mm-hmm.
but figure it out. You create neutrinos anytime you have K-capture. K-capture is when you convert an element from one to another element, and in the light elements you can create all kinds of neutrinos because you can convert light elements very easily with ultraviolet light, not to mention electric current. So as long as you're K-capturing a light element, which means just subjecting it to a certain voltage, and for the light elements the voltages are quite low. Like for instance, 7110 volts will cause iron to go into K-capture. And if you K-capture it, you will produce neutrinos. If it goes back to iron, it goes to iron to manganese, it emits neutrinos.
Mm-hmm.
And if it goes and it drops back to iron, then it draws neutrinos back in. And I think this has something to do with the way this pumping action works.
What's the physics behind moving from point A to point B? Is it linear, or is there some kind of a warp or space-time kind of stuff?
All that space warp, all that time travel stuff was created specifically
to hide
this material. Einstein himself believed in the ether. He knew there was an ether, and I have a paper that he wrote in 1919 and published in 1920 where he talks about it, yet he said it didn't exist. So that proves my point that he was concealing the ether because he was probably forced to. And they used his theories of relativity to cover up the real stuff, the ether physics.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to pass it into oblivion and make out like it didn't exist.
So going from point A to point B would be in a linear fashion.
Yeah.
Are they attaining the speed of light?
No.
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 So they couldn't go. In other words, the interstellar travel would not be very practical.
Well, if the mechanism for this point type of travel is related to these tubes that are spinning around,
mm-hmm.
Well, those tubes would be spinning at the velocity of light. And it stands to reason that if that's what's happening, okay, then they can only achieve a certain percentage of the velocity of light linearly because they're traveling in a circle around the ether particles along that axis. And so it's like a screw where the screw is rotating at the speed of light. It's not advancing at the speed of light. It's only advancing it at the amount of pitch it has per second. In other words, if it rotates fast enough to advance a foot per second, then that's how fast it goes, even though it may be spinning at the speed of light.
Now, let's talk about abductions, for example. What is behind abductions, and why are, you know, who's actually doing this?
That's just more of the same stuff. They copied all this stuff from the Third Reich. And in turn, the Rockefellers trained the Third Reich because they wanted to create a new religion to control the human race. And that's the first thing that the Third Reich set out to do, was to create a new religion, a new Gnostic religion.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they do is they use all of this stuff. They know that a religion has to have all this mystical stuff,
right,
in order to control people's thoughts. And so basically they have to stretch the credulity, and that's what paranormalism was invented for by Hitler's guru. You know, he's the guy, Hitler's guru was the guy who was the father of parapsychology. He invented it as part of the mass psychology system.
Who was that?
Let's see, what is his name? It's not Haushofer. It's, I can't think of his name right this minute. He was a mystic. For some reason, it slipped my mind.
Yeah.
But anyway, this guy's known as the father of parapsychology, and what they did is they used the big lie technique works like this. You stretch your credulity, and then the public credulity, then they'll accept any lie you tell them. And that's the idea of the parapsychological stuff.
That's social engineering right down the line.
And that was a mass psychology system that was used in Nazi Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Hitler said, you know, my intuition shall guide you, things like that, you know. Goes and consults his astrologer and a whole thing.
If you look at our culture today, we're practically there.
Yeah.
We consult crystal balls.
You know, we made such fun of that then. American people were a lot more rational in that.
Critical thinking.
In the 1940s than they are today.
Yeah.
They're a lot wackier. And if you unscrew everybody's mind from a rational epistemology,
Guess what? They're in the ether.
Yeah. They're loose screwed.
Yeah.
You know? It's just horrible, you know, and I see a lot of it. And I think the more people seem to get crowded into spaces, the wackier they get, too. And it's, you know, they're just so easily misled. I keep saying, you know, all people aren't going to fall for that corny crap.
Yeah.
They turn right around.
They do.
Be wrong.
Yeah, indeed.
I can't believe it.
We're talking about his research into saucer technology, and as you've heard, the last couple of hours have been quite interesting. A lot of information has been imparted. And, Bill, we're about out of time. I want to ask you one real quick question, and I want to get your web address and the particulars as to how folks can get copies of your book. Where is all of this going? I mean, ultimately, the political scene, the whole thing has to be involved in this at some point because, you know, a lot of people believe that something is getting ready to come to a head. And, you know, where is all this going? Do these people plan to use this in some bizarre way to basically enslave us, as some people are saying?
The way they have it set up now, and this is my position on it, this is my belief on it, I don't think they want to rock the boat. They just don't want us to rock the boat.
So they just want to keep this stuff tucked away.
They got us right where they want us.
And they mystify us.
Nothing but interest on the national debt.
Mm-hmm.
If we're getting too strong or too smart, they'll set the economy back and create a recession. Right now, there's a lot of information. People are getting awfully smart. I think that's what happened in the 1920s, and I think that's the reason that the Depression was created in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
People are starting to get too wise. And if you figure all of the major bank robbers in the 1920s and 30s, they were fighting the banks. They were fighting the Federal Reserve. You know, John Dillinger's family lost a fortune. He was a wealthy
mm-hmm.
man. He came from a wealthy family, and the bank took all their money.
There's an interesting history behind all this. Well, listen, we're out of time. You've got two books, Space Aliens from the Pentagon and Occult Ether Physics, Tesla's Hidden Space Propulsion System, and The Conspiracy to Conceal It. Give out the information about the price of the books, how people can get a copy.
Well, Space Aliens from the Pentagon is $17.95. And I'll ship it to you for $3. And that is ground. If you want air mail, then you have to figure on 1.3 pounds or so, you know, air mail. So it's considerably higher. Now, Occult Ether Physics is $8. And you can obtain this book either you can write me directly, General Delivery, Laney, New Mexico. That's Bill Lyne, L-Y-N-E.
And spell that town name.
Lamy, L-A-M-Y.
New Mexico.
New Mexico, 87540.
And give out your web address real quick, too.
And that is Pentagon Space Aliens. Or you can do a search for William R. Lyne or Pentagon Space Aliens or https://members.tripod.com/tilde/LYNE4LYNE/. It's case sensitive, all small letters.
Okay, very good. Bill, you've been a fascinating guest. Very, very glad to have you on the program. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Well, it was great being with you, Michael. I really enjoyed it. This is one of the best interviews I've had the pleasure of being on.
Well, thank you very much. And again, I've enjoyed interviewing you. That's it for us tonight. If you want to read